Wake up! You and Me S30 debuted on December 2nd, 2018. Over the past 8 months, I've interviewed guests on a wide range of topics. This morning, we're going to look back at some of the more memorable conversations, starting with an interview I did with Dr. Heidi Anderson, the president of the UMES, University of Maryland Eastern Shore. She shares her thoughts on the need for historically black colleges and universities.
What do you say to critics who argue that HBCUs are no longer needed in 2019 as they were in years past during Jim Crow and segregation?
That is not true. That's what I say to critics. But let me elaborate on that. HBCUs produce the most African American doctors, lawyers, pharmacists, health professionals, scientists, need I go on? Actors, performers, than any other institution. And that's going to continue. But more importantly, many of your HBCUs are a land-grant institution like we are. We're in 1890s. For our listeners out there, what that means is that the land-grant mission came with a dual role, to educate tomorrow's teachers, but also to help in the communities, and especially those areas of agriculture and science. And that means having a partnership with your communities and helping to find solutions to communities' problems. HBCUs are critical in that area. And let's talk about UMES. We're doing research in areas that deals with the water, marine research, soil research, research that can help cure, find cures for things like diabetes. And when you think about also HBCUs, those students out there or patients in the future, they want to see someone who looks like them. So these universities are so important and so valuable, and still they're valuable. Now, are we going to continue with the models of how the universities were in 1890 or 1800s? No, just like everything else, we have to evolve.
As Dr. Anderson stated, UMES, which is a HBCU, a historically black college and university, has produced some amazing students. This next excerpt features recent UMES alumni, Karen Holland, who was the Teacher of the Year in Worcester County, and Richard Warren, the 2018-2019 Teacher of the Year for the state of Maryland, and also a candidate for the National Teacher of the Year.
Is there a story that really sticks out to you over the years of teaching? Is there, like, you know, one special student that you really remember?
Yes, there actually is. I actually have this student right now, and even today, just looking at the growth that he's made and the progress that he's made is amazing. I have a student who's nonverbal, so he uses a device to communicate. And my first year with him, which was last year, he was very aggressive. But we know, you know, in education that all behaviors, you know what I mean, they're trying to tell you something. Students are trying to tell you something. But with that relationship piece that I was telling you about, I really focused hard on building that relationship prior to doing, you know, the academic portion, because he wasn't available for that just yet. And as we continue to grow together, he's made so many gains. He uses his device independently, pretty much, and he can say whatever it is he needs, he wants, and what he enjoys, which is amazing. And the behaviors have diminished. Like, they are no more.
Richard, I'm going to ask you the same question. Is there a special story that you have with one of your students that really sticks out to you?
The female student, and I met her. She was outgoing, and she gave her best to almost every opportunity. But then she had a traumatic turn in her life, and she came into my classroom and she slept for a few days. And, you know, I approached her, and I asked her what was going on. She told me that she wanted to drop out of school so she could help her mother survive and to take care of her family. And I told her the best way that she can help her family and her mother is to utilize education to get a good job, take care of her family. I found out that her mother was working multiple jobs just to make ends meet. And after that conversation, Shamir made it. She started dedicating herself to her work. And now, Shamir is a recipient of multiple scholarships. She's an honor student. She applied and got accepted to the University. college party. And more importantly, Shamira's mother came in and thanked me for being there for her daughter. And she was watching the entire time of how her daughter progressed through it all. So that kind of story speaks to the volume of how making connections and building relationships not only impacts student achievement, but it changes generational trends.
And we're certainly very proud of both Karen and Richard for all that they've accomplished as teachers out here on the Eastern Shore. One of my favorite episodes involved a group of current UMES students who participated in the study abroad program. Here, one of those students shares her experiences overseas.
So, Allison, let me actually start with you. Allison, you've been traveling since you were in high school, and while you've been here at UMES, you've completed trips to Spain. I believe you said you were doing an alternative winter break in the Dominican Republic as well. So just talk a little bit about, you know, how you got into study abroad.
I think it all started in high school, actually. My Spanish teacher took me on a trip to Costa Rica, and it was a Spanish immersion type trip. And I knew then that I wanted to go to more Spanish-speaking countries, which when I got to UMES and got into the honors program and learned about the Dominican Republic trip, I went on that trip, and then I took it again, and then I got the opportunity to actually study abroad for a whole summer in Spain. So it kind of was a domino effect.
Describe that experience, being there for an entire summer and having to adjust to a new country, a new culture.
It was definitely interesting, because not only did I stay there, but I also went to Morocco while I was there, and I went to Hungary. It was amazing seeing the different cultures. I lived with a host mother who spoke only Spanish, so it really, that was the main goal of the trip, was to improve my Spanish. So that definitely happened. My Spanish definitely improved. And just to see all the different cultures and all the different people, it wasn't really a big adjustment. I'm really open to difference, so I believe that I have an open mind, so I didn't really have a struggle.
So I know you said you've become pretty fluent in Spanish.
Yes.
Okay, so tell us, say something in Spanish.
Yo hablo español un poquito, pero yo necesito practicar más.
Okay.
I just said I speak Spanish a little bit, but I still need practice.
Okay. That was good, though. That's really good. So from your time overseas, how has that reshaped your worldview?
Well, I actually have one really good example, and I always thought of myself as really an aware person, but I remember when I was in Morocco, and I was on FaceTime with my parents and my sister, and I was telling them the things that I was seeing, and my mom kind of freaked out, and she was just scared for me because the things I was describing were things that were portrayed negatively here in America and in movies and stuff, and I had to kind of teach them about their culture, like the stuff that they wear and the stuff that they do, their religion, it's not a bad thing. And I think the media and propaganda and stuff like that here really has a negative effect on the way we look at other cultures. And to actually be in the culture and see what they're about, they're amazing people. So it was nice to kind of like change their mindset, because like I said, I like to see myself having an open mind, but to kind of open up the minds of the people back in my community.
Dr. Peter Levy, a professor of history at York College in Pennsylvania, joined me in December for one of our earlier shows to talk about a book he wrote some years back on race relations in Cambridge, Maryland during the 1960s. In this excerpt, you'll hear him talking about Gloria Richardson, who was a famous activist from Cambridge during that time period, and then also H. Rap Brown.
And I happened upon this movement that was led in Cambridge by this middle-aged woman named Gloria Richardson. And at the time, Richardson was virtually untalked about in most studies of the civil rights period. And she was an incredible person. She didn't start the movement, but her kids got involved after Freedom Riders came to the town, and they were getting dispirited. She became involved, and she came from a political family and, you know, within a year had built one of the most vibrant movements in the nation. Blacks and whites would try to ride in buses or attend restaurants or go to other public accommodations first along what we might call the western shore of Maryland and Delaware, and then over to the eastern shore of Maryland in 1962. And so those Freedom Riders came to Cambridge in early in 1962, and they were resisted. And a chapter of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was established, headed by Richardson. And he was pushing for fundamental equality. But so anyway, Richardson built this vibrant movement, and people largely just ignored it. So, you know, her story was interesting both because here she was a middle-aged mother and quite, I'm not sure militant's the way to put it. She just was a very determined person. You know, she was not going to accommodate the system. She held meetings and negotiations with Robert Kennedy, who was then the Attorney General of the U.S., and got an agreement for some change. But the community balked at a lot of the things that Richardson wanted. But then she all along had said, in terms of the question of nonviolence, she favored nonviolent protest, but felt that blacks have the right to defend themselves if they were attacked. And whites in the community frequently used the weapons against them, and she was not going to stop blacks from defending their homes and their person from those whites who shot at them. And she later on befriended Malcolm X, whose argument or kind of views of the world resonated with her. And then in terms of H.R.F. Brown, what happened is Richardson remarried a photographer of the civil rights movement, and moved with him to New York City in 1965. And the movement in Cambridge died down a little bit. In fact, kind of white reactionaries pretty much took over the city. And then local black activists tried to rejuvenate it in 1967. And they reached out to Richardson, and she helped bring H.R.F. Brown to town to give a speech. And the main goal of the speech was to really rejuvenate that movement. And he delivered a pretty fiery address. You know, started off by saying, essentially, if this town don't come around, we should burn it down. And later that night, a fire took place, and the town suffered, you know, serious damages, particularly the black community. And the recently elected governor of the state, this guy named Spiro Agnew, who would later become vice president, rushed to the town and immediately claimed that H.R.F. Brown was responsible. The newspapers repeated this. The police chief testified before Senate that Brown was the sole cause of the riots, claimed that Cambridge had good schools, good race relations. But interestingly, there were investigators who showed that this wasn't really the case at all. There was a National Guard commander general, a guy named General Gelston, who had been in town in the early 60s and was there in 67. He had his troops stand down after Brown's speech, because there was not a bunch of rioting and burning that took place. Rather, about 2-3 hours later, a small fire took place. And the fire force just refused to put it out. The fire force had been at odds with civil rights activists for years. It had actually been sued because they operated a pool in a segregated manner and refused to desegregate it. And the fire chief even admitted to a reporter of the African American that essentially the blacks had started that fire and, you know, he basically said, let them put it out, but then provided them no means to do so. But that story was buried, you know, that maybe some of the back pages of the newspapers briefly reported on it, but Brown became one of the most vilified people in the nation. And ultimately, in the early 70s, in fact, the Maryland state attorney dropped all riot-related charges against him. And the claim, at least, of that local attorney is that they had never had a case against him in the first place.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to UMES30. Today's episode looks back at some of the show's best moments over the year. If you listen to UMES30 regularly, you know that I love sports. I played sports in college, and from time to time, I've had shows that were dedicated to sports. One of our first episodes had student athletes from UMES. Recently, I spoke with Sean Gregory and Dexter Manley. Gregory, a senior sports writer for Time Magazine, and he also used to write for Sports Illustrated. He shares his experiences interviewing tennis champion Serena Williams. After that, you'll hear Dexter Manley, a two-time Super Bowl champion
with the Washington Redskins football team. Manley discusses his struggles to overcome illiteracy and drug addiction. Up first, this is Sean Gregory.
Last August, you wrote Time's cover story on women's tennis champion Serena Williams. What was it like interviewing Serena, and was there one thing that you learned in that interview that surprised you?
I went out there in San Jose between Wimbledon and the start of the U.S. Open, and she had made the finals at Wimbledon, coming back from a harrowing pregnancy. It was a very big story. People wanted to know how she was feeling, how she did it, and so we were lucky enough to get some time with her. The issue that happened was, out in San Jose, I spoke to her before a tune-up tournament for about 40 minutes, but we were supposed to do a really in-depth interview after, and then she lost in the first round. She really got destroyed. It was the worst loss of her career out in San Jose, and so I was worried, well, she might not be in the mood to talk, and what was surprising was it took a few days, but she really wanted to open up, and she really wanted to talk. And share the experience of, you know, going through the tough pregnancy and the details of it, and what she went through on the road back. And what was really eye-opening to me and surprising was, you know, she didn't talk about it after the match, but word had gotten out that the man who had killed her half-sister years ago in a case of mistaken identity in Compton had just been released from prison. And she had found out that news before the match, where she got obliterated, and obviously she was distracted. And so I kind of gingerly brought it up, and she wanted to talk about it. She talked about forgiveness. She talked about themes of how she was feeling and whether she was ready to forgive this person or not. And so during a quiet moment in her car, she just kind of, for the first time, really opened up about it. But what you're sitting down with somebody, you know, they're famous, but it sounds hokey, but it's just two people talking, and that's really what you want to get to.
That was Sean Gregory, senior sports writer with Time Magazine. And now here is the excerpt from my conversation with Dexter Manley.
So, Dexter, let's jump ahead a little bit to your pro days. So you win two Super Bowls with my beloved Washington Redskins. So, Dexter, when you're playing out there on the field and you're winning these Super Bowls, you're telling us that you couldn't read the playbook, that you were doing everything from memory.
I know the plays. I know when I hear the call, what's my responsibility. There was a certain defense that I was going to be in, and I knew that defense on memory. I knew what to do. If you don't know the plays, you don't play. And I was always making plays. So they would say, we got to keep the guy. We can't release the guy. But they worked with me.
How did you start using cocaine? Because earlier you talked about seeing all the guys from your neighborhood, how, you know, drugs had messed them up. So how'd you get on it?
That was an all-pro cornerback here. I lived in Reston. He lived in Reston. So I went over to his house one day. Nice home. He got a nice home and two or three Mercedes out here. And I'm just a rookie. I mean, I don't have none of this stuff. So I go to his home, and I see two women walk around in his home. And they got sleepwear on. This guy... there's another guy. He looks white. He drives a nice white Corvette. He pulled up to the house and gave him a brown bag. And then this guy tells me what the two girls gonna do. They're gonna have sex. They're gonna use drugs. I'm like, wow. You know, I was impressionable. Here's an 8-time All-Pro. So I saw that, but I didn't see him using drugs because I got out of there. That stayed in my mind. And so by the time my second year in the league, look, all the Redskins went there back in the 70s, the Over the Hill game, called a place called Paul Mall on M Street. I met a young lady there. First thing I asked her, hey, what is this stuff about cocaine? Do you know where to get some? She said, yes. So that's my first introduction. I gave her $100, and I've been off on the races until 2006.
So I know in D.C., especially in the 80s, cocaine was a big problem. So you had the powder cocaine, and then you also had the crack cocaine. Did you ever have any issues with crack, or was it solely powder cocaine?
Well, first, about the first, since 82 till probably about like 1993, that's when I started smoking the stuff. Okay. Yeah. And that was devastating. I lost a lot.
you've gone through quite a bit, and I know there was some failed drug tests, know, which cost you time in the NFL.
Yes.
And, you know, even, you know, landed you in prison a couple of different times. So during, like, all of this time period when you're going through these things, where was your faith in God? Because you talked about how you grew up as a kid and you always went to church. And, you know, so obviously faith was very important for you. You played for Joe Gibbs, who's known for being a very religious man.
Right.
I mean, where was your faith during all of this time period from the 80s up until before, you know, 2006?
When I was a little kid, it was mandatory I go to church. Mm-hmm. Now, when I became a high school football player, All-American, all sought after, it was all me then. It was all me. I got full of myself, and I put my religion on the back burner. It wasn't important to me no more because now I had, listen, when I left the Yanks, I had 37 scholarship offers. People was coming in my home, and, you know, it was all about me. And all of a sudden, when I got to Oklahoma State, I would go to church every once in a while, especially when I got to the Redskins. It's like, that was so far on the back burner until I started having difficulties. Then I had to renew my faith. I had to go back and figure out how to get myself together. Even when I was with the Redskins, it never crossed my mind that to reach back in my faith or my belief, because now I was so caught up in the drug and in that lifestyle. Until June 16th, once I had that surgery, had to renew my faith, had a chance to live again. Because a lot of people don't make it.
The final two segments provide suggestions for listeners desiring to improve their finances and their overall happiness. J.R. Fenwick quit his job and launched a million-dollar company. He provides tips for navigating the stock market. After that, you'll hear Reverend Daniel Graham, a chaplain at the Penn Medicine Princeton Medical Center, New Jersey, as she provides advice for living your best life through the practice of self-care. What are, like, the biggest myths today in regards to getting involved in the stock market and the risk that you'll have to take if you want to start investing or trading?
People think that, you know, the stock market is gambling. No, it's not. Stock market is not gambling when you know what you're doing. Gambling is going in the stock market when you don't know what you're doing. Then it is gambling. People think that you have to have a license or a degree or a certificate in order to buy and sell stocks for yourself. Not true. So that keeps a lot of people out. They think that you have to be rich. Well, I got to be rich to get involved. No. Maybe people got rich by getting in the stock market. You know, if you look at all these companies like Amazon and Jeff Bezos and Microsoft and Bill Gates, they got rich by getting in the stock market. Their wealth comes from their stock ownership in their companies. So you don't have to be rich to get involved. Another one is, it's just too complicated. It's too complicated. Learning to drive a car is far more complicated than learning how to trade and invest in the stock market. When you're taught by the right person and you're willing to invest your time, energy, and money into learning, you got to learn it, get committed to it, and it is not hard. People just, it's not. That's the one thing that it just amazes me. But I get it. When you see all this stuff on TV and on the computer, it looks complicated.
To quit my job and build a million-dollar company, what do you think about E-Trade and similar companies?
E-Trade is a fine company. You can go open an account at E-Trade, put $1,000 in or more, and you still don't know what you're doing. You're relying on them to do it. And I hear this all the time. I gave my money to a broker, just like I did when I first started, didn't know what was going on. You never, ever, ever lose when you educate yourself on something, even if you're going to have somebody else do it for you.
Self-care is simply like the word says. It's caring for yourself, taking good care of yourself. And as I tend to talk about it, it's not just looking at physical health, but it should be care for your mental health, your emotional health, your spiritual health. All facets of who we are as human beings. And self-care can fall on the spectrum and include lots of different things.
So like all things, self-care is a process and it can't be achieved overnight. What are five basic steps that our listeners should take to begin this process?
One would be to check your sleeping habits. I think a second one would be looking at your eating habits. I think a third one is
checking your work-life balance. I think a fourth one would definitely be exercise. And then five, finding ways to express yourself. How do you like to be creative?
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. I couldn't include every episode in the show, but you can find other past episodes by going to Google and typing in Joshua K. Wright, WESM, and you'll be able to pull up the past episodes there and listen to them in full. Shows that I recommend include the one on policing with retired Washington, D.C. police officer Lydia Polk, and also former UMES Chair of Criminal Justice, Dr. Lorenzen Boyd. There's a good episode that we did with U.S. District Judge George Hazel, who offered some valuable insight on the judicial system. Retired UMES professor John Winterston discussed the effects of environmental change in the Chesapeake Bay. Rick Whitehurst, who was one of my earlier interviewees, shared his experiences serving in the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War. Maria Davis has lived with AIDS for over 10 years. She gives a very powerful testimony about what she's done to overcome that and how now she uses her story to educate others. And then there are much more lighthearted episodes as well that we did something on, popular TV shows, millennials and marriage. There was an episode on how to run for political office if you're thinking about getting involved in politics. And then there was an episode about getting more women involved in the STEM career field. So all good episodes. We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. Earlier this summer, I was offered and accepted a new teaching position at Trinity Washington University in Washington, D.C. As a result, I'm leaving UMES. I must thank all of my UMES students, co-workers, mentors, administrators, and staff members for making me a special part of the Hawks family these past years that I've been at the school. Hawk pride, catch it. I've grown tremendously as an educator, a scholar, and a man during my stay here. Please wish me luck and keep me in your prayers as I move on to this next chapter in my life. This is my final episode of UMES 30. It's been a great time spending every Sunday with you for the last 8 months. I want to thank everyone at WESM 91.3, in particular, Gerald Weston and Brian Daniels and Angel. And I also want to thank NPR as well, National Public Radio, for providing me this platform. I want to thank all of my listeners for supporting the show. Hopefully you all enjoyed it and got something out of it. Now, they say don't ever completely shut the door. So there is a chance that I may return at some point to the airwaves in the near future. So, you know, we'll see what happens. What I'll say in regards to that is just stay tuned. And that's our show for the week. A special shout out, as always, one last time, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day, everybody.
Listen to this or any past episode of UMES 30 by logging on to WESM913.org or through the NPR One app available for download on Google Play. UMES 30 is produced in the studios of 91.3 WESM, located on the campus of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. The views and opinions expressed on UMES 30 are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.